Miller versus Donnelly. We'll hear from Mr. Attig.
May it please the court, esteemed counsel for the government. My name is Chris Attig with the Attig Law Firm in Dallas, and I represent the appellant Terrence Filer. One thing that the briefs in this case bring out is that there is a genuine dispute of material fact between the parties as to whether the public display of a noose in the context of the civilian employment sector of the government rises to the level of a racially hostile work environment.
Well, let me just ask you a question. When your client found out that the noose had come from Afghanistan, I mean, didn't that put a different light on it?
I don't think my client believed that explanation. I don't know that the other witnesses found any credibility.
Well, they do a lot worse things in Afghanistan, so I'll take your word for it. I just wondered.
Certainly, and the record bears forth that there were other witnesses that did not find a whole lot of sufficiency in Mr. Rourke's explanation that it came from Afghanistan. The court here today faces two questions of law, and one of those is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, whether the claim that the civilian work environment was racially hostile for this dual status employee that spends part of his time in a military status and part of his time in a civilian status. The second question is whether the trial court erred in granting summary judgment for the defendant when it failed to view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff in this case. Turning to the first question, though, the court's holding in Brown is sufficient for this case, and I think the trial court recognized that. Brown distinguished between acts that occurred or originated, claims that originated in the civilian sphere, and claims that originated in the military sphere. And in that case, they said that the civilian claims are justiciable, and the ones in the military sphere are non-justiciable. And I think the facts of this case draw out that clearly these claims originate in the civilian sphere, and the court need not expand on the holding in Brown.
It does seem to me there's an odd quirk in this case about the retroactive labeling of his service during that few days. Does that alter it at all? I mean, I don't quite understand what happened, but apparently under the technician rules or the military rules, what was initially civilian technician work became his military duty work.
That's my understanding, Your Honor, is that at the time that these dual status employees in the Air Force, as distinguished from other dual status type employees that this court has looked at before, when they spend their time in status, they can, after the fact, go in and ask their supervisor, their military supervisor, to count that time as military time, so long
as they satisfy their duty obligations as a reservist.
Yes, Your Honor. And they do have to request leave time and their civilian employment in order to make sure that they're not double dipping, as it were. But that's what happened in this case.
If the word technically is even the right word, but they're under some conception then, retroactively, he was on military status when he saw the news.
Looking at this case in the context of how it developed at the time, though, Your Honor, clearly at the time that the news was put on display and at the time that my client saw the news and other employees saw the news, they were all under the impression that they were acting in a civilian capacity, in the civilian sphere. And the after-the-fact submission of this document doesn't change that fact. I don't think it even adds any confusion to whether or not it clearly originates in the military or the civilian sphere, though. It may add a slight amount, but not enough that this court would need to go beyond Brown. Certainly, I think the court recognized in Walsh, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that there was some question whether Ferris could reach into a dual status employee's hostile work environment claim. And the court was looking at Overton, I believe, was the case out of the Second Circuit, or a district court in the Second Circuit. And I don't think the facts of this case reached the level that the court needs to modify the holding of Brown. I think another case could come along in the future where the court might want to look into that in more detail, and the facts might give the court the ability to make a more clear, concrete decision whether it's going to go with a test along the lines of Mir, whether when there's confusion we're going to look at what's integrally related, or whether we're going to look at the Gertoff test that looked at some pretty specific factors of what was and was not in the military sphere.
Does the fact that the military conducted a significant investigation of this matter mean anything here?
In the terms of this case, Your Honor, no, it does not. There was an investigation. The conclusions of those investigations are a fact, just like anything else.
Well, but doesn't it indicate that this was treated as if it was something for which the military person could be disciplined.
Well, by that token,
had they found something else.
By that token, then, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. There is the entire claim process was handled in the civilian forum. There was an informal complaint in the civilian EEO, a formal complaint, an administrative hearing. All the way through the process was handled through the civilian EEO. That the military also appointed a command-directed investigation to look into this does suggest that they are recognizing that there are dual roles of these employees and that conduct in one sector could affect conduct in another sector or conduct in one sector.
Why isn't that the gravamen of the jurisdictional problem?
I don't.
That's the whole point of taking these things out of civilian courts.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I think it goes to what the standards were in some of the other court cases that are looked at. Gentoft looked at whether or not there were some discrete personnel actions, enlistment, transfer, discipline, to say these are the things that are envisioned, I think, by the Ferris and Brown cases to limit the court's jurisdiction into looking into the military. This case is different in the sense that we're not looking into the military actions. We're looking, given that the facts at the time they occurred, these individuals were in a civilian capacity, we're not asking the court to look into decisions that were made in the military context. Certainly those facts would be admissible, I think, because of the fact that they occurred, and simply because they occurred does not mean that we, in the military sphere, does not mean that we can ignore them. But we're not asking for a remedy for those, and we're certainly not asking the court, as the trial court recognized, to look into the adequacy of the military discipline or the inadequacy of the military discipline. It is what it is. In this case, what we're asking the court to look at is the incident of the noose. We're asking the court to look at the background evidence of this civilian work environment, the violation of civilian workforce policies, or the allegations of those violations, the allegations of preferential treatment among civilian employees in the Department of the Air Force. We're asking them to look at whether this swastika incident that occurred 2 years prior in the same work group, a claim that I might add was raised by a civilian, bared any relation.
Why does the swastika uniquely affect a black person?
In the context of what this court has held in the past is that there are cross categories of discrimination, and the court has not held that necessarily that cross categorization is admissible, but it has suggested that there are times that when the incidents are similar, when there's an incident of discrimination against one protected group versus another protected group.
So if there's a picture of a naked woman, that could be introduced too?
I don't think so. In this case, the swastika and the noose have and it may be. In this case, looking at the swastika and the noose, both of these speak to a pro-Aryan culture, the very type of culture, the good old white boys network that my client and others complained of.
Would this go to a jury if you had the opportunity?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, we would very much like the opportunity to take this case before a jury. I think that the key question and really the crux of this matter is whether the single display over a day or more days of a noose in a federal government civilian workplace.
Judge McBride is known for his candor. Did he ever tell you that he thought there was nothing to this case?
Beyond the orders that appear in the record, no, Your Honor.
Just wondered.
Now, when did your client become aware of the swastika incident? That was 2 years before?
It was 2 years prior to the noose incident. My client did not become aware of it until well after the fact. I believe we were in litigation. It might have even been at the administrative phase, but he was not aware of it at the time that the noose was displayed. And I don't think that that necessarily matters because the court is looking for the hostile work environment at two factors, a subjective assessment and an objective assessment. Subjectively speaking, whether or not he knew of the swastika is wholly irrelevant because he perceived the workplace to be hostile on other grounds. Objectively speaking, if the court or the trier of fact, as it were, is going to stand in the shoes of the reasonable person or my client and act as a reasonable person, whether or not my client knew of the swastika incident does not change the fact that it affected other employees. And certainly this court has found...
Your client can't sue for other employees.
He can't sue for other employees. That's correct, Your Honor. But
Under Title VII, since when? You have to sue for your own damages.
No, I was saying you're correct, Your Honor. He cannot, and I apologize. I must have spoken too quickly.
Yes.
He cannot sue, but he can bring in evidence of other discrimination, third-party discrimination. In fact, this court has held that even though a woman herself may not be a victim of discrimination, other women in the workplace who are victims of discrimination, that's admissible evidence to help prove the hostility of the work environment towards women. And in this case, the hostility of a work environment, not necessarily just towards African Americans, but by whites against, in the case of the swastika, Jewish employees that are either ethnically or religiously Jewish, or in the case of my client, an African American employee. Certainly all of these factors, the noose, the background evidence, all of this, none of it probes into the military integral structure of the military, and none of it asks the court to go that way.
I suggest to you that the military is one of the most hypersensitive environments to claims of discrimination of anything that we have in this country.
I would certainly, having been served in the military myself, Your Honor, I'm well aware that is the case and would absolutely agree with you that there
so
is a hypersensitivity.
Why would you want to superimpose the possibility of money damages on people who are already not paid very well? Isn't that the consequence of what you're doing?
No, Your Honor, we're actually just suing the United States Air Force as a government entity. I do not believe we sued, and I'm sure we did not sue individual members in their own accord. Mr. Work was not sued individually, just the government as a whole. And certainly the government is as liable as any other party for its bad acts. And that's what we're asking this court for, is an opportunity to present to a jury to determine whether the government is liable under the facts of this case. The trial court, in ruling in favor of the defendant on their summary judgment motion, failed to give us that opportunity, and we believe they did so in error because of the fact that they failed to view the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. First and foremost, the court found that there was no evidence of any impact on the terms and conditions of the employment of the plaintiff, and that simply is not the case. In the agreed material facts of the joint pretrial order submitted shortly before the court issued its summary judgment ruling, at facts number 103 to 104, the defendant agreed that there was an impact on work performance. There was certainly a policy of the civilian side of the Air Force that entitles employees to a workplace free of discrimination and racial hostility. The plaintiff himself testified at deposition that it did impact his work performance, that he had significant depression just driving into work after this incident occurred. The court did not take those factors into account in its decision, and we believe that they erred by failing to resolve those factual disputes in our favor.
Weren't there actions taken after your client complained, actions taken to remedy the situation? And how do those come into the picture?
There were some actions taken. Whether or not they remedied the problem, I don't believe they did. The actions that were taken was the day of the incident, Mr. Rourke's supervisor suggested to my client that he go home and think about it over the weekend. Short of that, and short of the actual removal of the noose, I'm not aware of any other corrective actions that were taken at that time. Over the course of time, the government claims that they gave a course to supervisors about certain objects in the workplace, and evidence from our side suggested that was nothing more than, and quoting one of the witnesses, a two-second spiel into what not to bring to work. There was some evidence the government will present that there was an oral reprimand of Mr. Rourke, and certainly on our side of the aisle we have the argument that the civilian penalty guide recommends a minimum of a reprimand, a written reprimand, and a maximum of a 5-day suspension for just an ethnic slur, not even going into the display of a symbol as offensive and violent and hostile as a noose. There's no indication in the record, or at least Mr. Rourke testified at deposition, that he wasn't aware what the consequences would be if he were to do that again. And certainly I would posit the question to Mr. Rourke, on the stand, is how would he think that remedies the problem, the display of the noose, if he's not aware of what would happen? If the government cannot...
Are you aware of how many cases this court has rejected hostile sexual environment claims because we found that the incidents, which can be 2, 3, even 4, don't rise to the level of something that shatters the terms and conditions of employment? I mean, I just think all you've got is a noose. You don't have bad language. You don't have offensive conduct toward this person, and I'm just sort of surprised that this is pursued.
I'm aware of the court's recent holdings, and I would also present that in our position, a noose is an overt racist symbol. It talks not only of race, just it's more than beyond calling an individual a slur that
it's
begins
a
with the letter N.
It's hung on a complaint form. I mean, you know, if you put it in context, it's just like having a skeleton somewhere. I mean, it's on its complaint deal. It says, don't give me any complaints. It doesn't say, don't give me any complaints because you're black. I just think as an aesthetic matter, even that. But even if that were that, I mean, I would be hard put to say that one isolated incident could ever rise to the level of a hostile work environment.
What the noose means to Mr. Rourke is largely irrelevant in this case. What the noose means to Mr. Filer is very relevant. The noose itself...
No, because we don't do this on a subjective basis. This is objective. The test for harassment is objective.
It's two parts, Your Honor, subjective and objective. In terms of the objective standard, I would posit to this court that a noose is so overtly racist and so imbued with the history of violent attacks on African Americans throughout the history of this country, throughout the history of the South, and throughout the history of Texas, where men and women and children were hung simply because they were black, that the mere appearance of a noose in a government workplace presents that individual with a threat to his very safety, to his very life, and conveys the message to him that your life by this noose is not worth living because you are black.
All right, thank you. You're entitled to rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Parker.
May it please the court? Counsel. I am Tammy Parker. I'm an assistant United States attorney here on behalf of Secretary Donnelly. As an initial matter, Secretary Donnelly asserts that there is no subject matter jurisdiction in this case. This court, through Brown, adopted the EEOC's interpretation of military department. Well, let me back up. Title VII is a waiver of sovereign immunity, but it is a limited waiver. In Title VII, it does note that the United States sovereign immunity is waived with respect to military departments, but the EEOC has interpreted that provision as precluding suits by uniformed members of our armed forces. And this, that's 29 CFR 1614.103. In this case, although Tech Sergeant Filer attempts to recharacterize his leave as having been retroactively set, if you look at the document that's in the record and the document that Tech Sergeant Filer says bears his signature and is the copy of his orders to active duty, that document was authorized in May of 2007, so 3 months before the duty was actually taken in September of 2007. So although they may wish to recharacterize it as when I signed it, I was saying I wanted last week to be my active duty week, the document ordering Tech Sergeant Filer to active duty was signed in May. He was on active duty. Title VII does not waive the United States sovereign immunity for active duty members of the military. So we would say as an initial proposition, there is no subject matter jurisdiction to hear this case given that that Tech Sergeant Filer was in an active duty status.
Ms. Parker, let me ask you about the May order you're talking about. Is it your position, does the order state that on the date in question that he was ordered to active duty, or is it authorized him to serve and it's up to the 301st, whatever the number of this unit was, to decide when he is going to serve that?
It gives the specific week, Your Honor. And these are not part of the court's actual record, but it's Exhibit 1 to Defendant's Summary Judgment Evidence, and it's page 1. The document specifically notes that the reporting date for Mr. Filer to begin his active duty, this is in box 14, is September 17, 2007. And it gives his release date as September 21st, 2007. That's in box 15. Mr. Filer comes in at the end and certifies that he served those particular days and an active duty status. But and this document was electronically signed by Lieutenant Colonel Coops, who is Mr. Filer's third line military supervisor. So our first proposition is that there has been no waiver of sovereign immunity in this particular case for this case to proceed under Title VII. But even if the court disagrees,
Before you leave, let's deal with this a little bit more. I had missed that order. I thought this was done retroactively, and we'll have to see about that. Now, generally, on active duty, there can be a different command structure, different duties, what his reservist duties are versus his civilian technician, military technician duties, but civilian status. When he was encountered this noose, whether he was in civilian or military status, depending on the effect of what you're talking about, who was he dealing with? Are these people he was dealing with that he has no, that have no responsibility over him when he is on his reserve duty? Or are these, is this his same supervisors, his same workplace? Or is that even in the record?
It is in the record, Your Honor. Tech Sergeant Filer's first line military and civilian supervisors were the same, and that was Master Sergeant Drewark. So when he complains that he was asked to go home and think about it over the weekend, the person who is making that recommendation was both his military and his civilian supervisor.
Do we know what status the supervisor was in?
Chief Master Sergeant Rourke.
Whoever told him to go home.
That was that was Master Sergeant Drewark, and he was the civilian and military supervisor. We do not know, the record does not reflect whether he was in an active duty military status, Mr. Drewark, at the time. The record does not reflect that. Mm-hmm. Does that?
Yes, that was my question. Thank you.
We know that Chief Master Sergeant Rourke was not in Mr. Filer's immediate command in terms of our immediate hierarchy. But the deciding official in this case, Lieutenant Colonel Coops, was Tech Sergeant Filer's third line military supervisor. He was Chief Master Sergeant Rourke's second line military supervisor, and he was Chief Sergeant Rourke's first line civilian supervisor. So when the argument is made that we are not seeking to haul military superiors into court and we're just looking at civilians, they're too intertwined for this to be a purely civilian case. The decisions that were made by people who were in Chief Staff Sergeant Rourke's military command. And the decisions that they were making were decisions that were also inherently military.
Well, counsel, I mean, the case law has developed that you do look at whether the technician is serving in a military capacity or a civilian capacity. And it seems to me what you're arguing now is trying to erase those distinctions. And often there may be, some sort of logical level, maybe some merit to it, but this is a line that has been drawn. I mean, Brown draws it, Walsh draws it, the other cases draw it. And it seems to me the only thing different about this case is this oddity that there's this potentially this pre, well, there is, I mean, you told us this pre-existing order that said he was supposed to be on military duty at that time. But it seems to me a lot of your argument would erase the distinction altogether between civilian technicians, people serving under these programs as technicians, who also are serving on military status at other times. So we need to, don't you agree, don't we need to keep that divide? It's already there. We need to make sure we're not erasing that divide.
Well, we're not asking the court to erase the divide, but there is the very, if you look at the small handful of decisions out there that address ferries in the context of dual status technicians, they use different standards. They look at, this court looks at whether it's purely military or purely civilian. We look at whether it's irreducibly military. That's what the Sixth Circuit looks at. We looked at whether it's integrally related to the military's unique structure. There's lots of different tests out there. But in all cases, what we are looking at is whether this court's involvement in the facts of the case would result in an unreasonable intrusion into military-related command decisions and policies. That's what the cases are getting at. So yes, there is a divide, but the overarching picture we're looking at is, does the court need to get involved in decisions that should be military and that are inherently military?
But haven't we held that if it's dual status civilian half, we do get involved? We haven't actually had to face that case, but that's been the division that we have recognized.
The court has held that we will get involved as long as the conduct and the actions that this court is asked to look at can be classified as purely civilian as opposed to purely military. That's when the court's going to get involved. If we can keep this at a purely civilian review, the court gets involved. And the secretary would argue that that can't happen in this case and in cases like this. Although they would ask that we limit this to just looking at the noose. The fact of the matter is, under our case law, under our Fifth Circuit case law on hostile work environment, the fifth element that they're required to prove for a prima facie case is whether prompt remedial action was taken. And the prompt remedial action for this court to review it requires a review of military decisions. There is no summary judgment competent evidence to challenge the fact that Lieutenant Colonel Koontz, although the investigation determined that there was no evidence of racial intent, he withheld a military promotion. The record shows that Mr. Wark was entitled to promotion at the time of the events in question. That promotion was withheld for a year. So to say that that is not prompt remedial action requires this court to review a decision that is a military decision. The record shows that Lieutenant Colonel Koontz had intended to award a medal for actions taken in Iraq. That medal was withheld because of this event. So to look at whether prompt remedial action took place in this case, which is part of the prima facie case, requires this court to look at actions that are inherently military. And that is the type of review that Brown and Walsh and Williams and the Supreme Court line of cases says this federal court should not do. Similarly, and it was an issue that was raised by the court, there were three phases of investigations that took place following the noose incident. You had an informal EEO proceeding. You had a command-directed inquiry into this event. So the commander of the 301st sent in a commissioned officer to review the events that took place and determine whether there was an effect on the efficiency of the organization. This lawsuit is asking the court to second guess that inquiry that has already been made by the military. And as a result of that inquiry, the decision was made that there was no racial intent in the noose being added to the complaint department. It was bad judgment, and the command-directed inquiry noted that fact, but there was no racial intent, and this court should not second-guess that decision as made by the military command. The question was asked whether this would be a jury trial if it went back. And certainly one of the overriding considerations that we see in the Ferries cases is whether or not we'd be hauling military superiors into court. That's exactly what they wish to do here. As noted earlier, Lieutenant Colonel Koontz was Tech Sergeant Filer's third line military supervisor. When they conducted the deposition that's in the record at 2009, Lieutenant Colonel Koontz was stationed in Iraq. They're seeking to haul into court military supervisors to review how those supervisors handled a matter that arose while Tech Sergeant Filer was on active duty and how they disciplined disciplined Mr. Rourke. These are hard distinctions, and again, we're not asking the court to blur the distinctions, but the fact of the matter is we're in a war situation at the time of the events in question.
Why do you speculate the district court just brushed off your arguments? Because he did.
Well, I have to be careful here, but this particular district court is one that bristles at any argument that seeks to limit his authority to deal with cases that are in his.
Well, that may be, but I mean, normally he reads the law pretty carefully, so I'm just sort of interested that he didn't, that he just said this is a hostile environment case and therefore it is not like the others, and that was the end of it. So I'm assuming you made the same arguments to the district court that you're making to us.
Yes, the same arguments were made, although I have no record that the provisions of Defendant's Exhibit 1, that he was ordered to active duty in advance. Okay. I don't know if that was specifically pointed out to the district court.
Okay.
Nor do I know if the 1614 counsel before you was not counsel below. The record's not clear that 1614's limitation on active duty employees filing suit under Title VII was specifically directed to the district court.
Okay.
This case is about the supervisor's poor judgment in an effort at humor for his troops. There's no dispute that it was a colossally bad decision to supplement his complaint department. However, the undisputed evidence in the record does not suggest that single act of adding a noose to a novelty complaint department rose to the level of a hostile work environment. The evidence does not suggest that there was an environment that was so permeated with discriminatory insult and ridicule that it would destroy a reasonable person's efforts to succeed in the workplace. And if the court goes back and looks at the cases where they talk about the fact that a single noose could possibly give rise to a hostile work environment, the facts in those cases are so different than the facts that were before the district court in this case. So you have EEOC versus Noble, where white coworkers tied a noose around the neck of an African-American employee who was sleeping. And when the employee woke up, there was a noose around the neck. The court said that single act could rise to the level of a hostile work environment.
That's clearly directed to the plaintiff.
I'm sorry.
That is clearly directed to the plaintiff.
Exactly. Those are the types of issues that courts look at. Is it directed at a specific party? In this case, there's no evidence that the noose was directed at Tech Sergeant Filer. They look at whether we know who displayed the noose or not, because certainly if you don't know who put up the noose, that could create more fear and intimidation than if you knew. But in this case, the noose was in a private office attached to a complaint department. So there's no question about where the noose came from. There's no dispute that there's no history of any discriminatory intent, comment, promotions, discipline by Chief Master Sergeant Rourke. It is a single isolated incident. There is no dispute that once he learned that Tech Sergeant Filer was offended by the noose, he took it down immediately. He threw it away. There was an investigation. He was punished. He was punished militarily. These facts do not give rise to a hostile work environment under this court's precedent. finally, I would note that although Tech Sergeant Filer continues to press all of these background facts, background promotions, background discipline, as set forth in the Secretary's appellate brief, there was no summary judgment competent evidence supporting these allegations. They may have perceived that promotions were unfair, but they presented no evidence of that. He may have perceived that discipline was unfair. He presented no evidence of that. So the fact of the matter is, on the summary judgment record, summary judgment in favor of the Secretary was appropriate, and we would ask that the case be dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. But in the alternative, we would ask that the case, the district court's grant of summary judgment, based on the fact that there was no summary judgment competent evidence to support a claim of hostile work environment, we would ask that that be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Mr. Addy.
May it please the court. First, to the question regarding this document requesting military duty time. The date May 31st, 2007, though the record does not explain the document in the clear context of the document, that is the date that the funding authority was approved for that. The actual dates
on
the...
have it in front of you? You don't? I mean, what is the document?
The document, it's a request for a duty time. I do not have a copy of it.
So it's something signed by him requesting duty?
It's signed by him on September 24th, 2007, by the plaintiff. Signed by his supervisor, his military supervisor, on September 26, 2007, and date-stamped September 26, 2007 by the agency that received it, the Accounting
Bureau.
So this
is the same, maybe not the same document, but the same request for retroactive characterization of this as military service?
It's the same exact document, Your Honor. Okay. There's an upper section which has the identifying information of the individual, then the lower section identifies the funding authority, and it's typed in there electronically, signed by, I believe, William Koontz. Colonel Pottinger, as the funding authority. Below that, the plaintiff requested and signed on September 24th for specific days. It was approved by his military supervisor on September 26th and received by the accounting department and date stamped on September 26th, all after the date of the incident. Regarding the government's claim that we're trying to hail the military supervisors into court, any time that there is an individual that serves in a military and in a civilian capacity, if that individual comes into court, he's being hailed or she's being hailed into court. The question is, which hat are they wearing? And this court has always said you can, and other courts have indicated, that you can only wear one hat at a time. There's no two-color military-civilian hat. You're either in a military capacity or you're in a civilian capacity. We argue that the events in this case occurred when everybody was wearing civilian hats. Certainly, as to the, just to clear up one issue, we didn't depose the individual while he was in Iraq. That date and time was proffered by the government's attorney at the administrative level. Certainly, had there been any inclination that they were unavailable because of combat duty in Iraq, I would not have taken that deposition.
I don't think she directed it to that specific fact as much as to the more general proposition that this is an involvement in the military affairs, the very nature of the second-guessing of the way in which the whole thing was handled.
And the government made those choices. Mr. Rourke appeared for deposition in his military uniform. He made that choice. He was not being deposed in his military capacity. He was being deposed as a civilian. He made the choice to wear a uniform, a choice that is entirely his to make. In terms of the government's position, that part of our prima facie case is that we have to show that the government did not take prompt remedial action. I understand what the government's saying. I'm not sure that there is a prima facie case element such as that in a hostile work environment. I think what the government is alluding to is its affirmative defense, that if it can show that it took substantial or significant action to correct or prevent the action in the future, then it will not be liable. And to that extent, there is evidence that shows that the government, at least that could be argued before a trier of fact, that could be argued whether or not that's sufficient. As to the competency of the summary judgment evidence, the district court or the trial court judge made no express holdings on the competency of any evidence, and so there is nothing for the court here to review. Though the standard is de novo, If there is no ruling by the judge to review, it seems that the wiser course, and that's probably inappropriate to suggest, it seems like the course of action we're requesting is that the court would send it back to the trial court to provide the assessment of the competency so that this court can more adequately and more competently review it. With that, we do urge this court to find that a single noose does constitute a racially hostile work environment. We don't think the court needs to hold that way to grant a remedy for the plaintiff. They can merely find that the court failed to consider all the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff in the summary judgment motion. And certainly, we don't think that the court's holding in Brown needs to be any further dissected for this particular case, though we do recognize that there could arise a case where that might be so. Thank you for your time.
All right, sir. Thank you.